conference record has joined the conference.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, it's Stephen Gerloff.
Hi, this is Elizabeth Kraginski. I think I'm also on the call.
It is a conference call on the Pay for Success School Finance.
Correct.
Bonds. Okay.
That's what I'm on for.
All right. And apparently we both are equally concerned to be early.
Exactly.
Hello, it's Rob Duggar.
Rob,
I got two voices there.
Yes, this is Horacio Tanasia. I'm calling from London.
Hey, terrific. Good. Good to have you on the call.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's see. I think perhaps somebody at the University of Chicago is on the call. Allison or any of those? Okay.
Hello. This is Valerie. I'm on the call. I was having unmute trouble.
Hi, Valerie. How are you? This is the correct number for me to call in?
Yes, this is the correct number.
Excellent. Very good. I think the meeting literally has begun now. Is that correct?
Yes.
1 o'clock on your clock. And how many people do we have on the call? Do you know?
We have about 10 people on the call right now, and more people are joining.
Okay. Can they all hear me now?
Yes, they should be able to.
Oh, excellent. Very good. Hi. This is Rob Duggar. I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm co-director of the Human Capital and Economic Opportunity Global Working Group with Jim Heckman and Steve Derloff. I'm also the advisory board chairman of a group called Ready Nation, ReadyNation.org. It's an organization that is part of the America's Promise Alliance, Colin Powell's high school graduation increase initiative here in the United States. While we wait for a few other people to get on, let me tell you a little bit about the origins of this whole line of work. In the spring of 2003, Jim Heckman, Art Rolnick, and I had a conversation about the areas where the United States needed to invest resources that would have a positive rate of return. Our principal concern at the time was the debt. The economy was being effectively, GDP was effectively being paid for by debt increases. We had debt increasing at 8%. GDP increasing at 3%, and we knew that that was unsustainable. We needed to find those areas or identify those areas where resources could be put at significant positive returns. We looked at energy, information technology, environment, a host of areas, and settled on education. The policy group focused on education, where the returns were highest, and those were clearly at the earliest years, prenatal to five. We formed something called the Investing Kids Working Group in the fall of 2000. And those of you who are listening, what I'm doing is kind of going through a history of the organization that ended up producing this report. Obviously, we're on a conference call. If I could ask you to do a couple of things, if you're just listening, go ahead and put your phone on mute. Some of you are calling on digital phones, and where the digital connect, the digital signal doesn't align with this one, we get these kind of beeps and groans and that sort of thing. So if you hear those, if you kindly hang up and call again, and then the signal will be aligned, perhaps, and we won't have those problems. Or put the phone on mute. Perhaps that works. The other thing I need to ask you to do is if you must, it looks like I'm giving the echo on this line. What I'm going to do, Valerie, is I'm going to hang up and call back in on the line using a landline and do it that way, if you don't
okay.
mind. It seems like my phone is the one that's creating the kind of echo sound on the phone. So I'll call back in. Thanks. Valerie, it's Rob Duggar again. Hopefully that's a clearer signal for folks. The Investing Kids Working Group met monthly for 2004, 2005, 2003. We're looking at a wide range of early childhood interventions, looking at the microeconomics, the macroeconomics, sector definition, the financing, of which this is a outgrowth. And lastly, advocacy. The Investing Kids Working Group grew from about five people around the table and on conference calls to nearly 1,000 in about 18 months. It was pretty clear that the research we were doing was on a wide range and was formed, organized into a partnership with the Pew Charitable Trust. Partnership with the Pew Charitable Trust was called the Partnership for America's Economic Success, and it operated, continuing to do work in those five areas: the microeconomic returns of early childhood interventions, the macroeconomic job creation and economic growth implications if you do all of these things in a effective way. We looked at the sector, how large is the sector of the economy that raises children from conception to career. We found that from prenatal to 18 is over 10% of GDP, and prenatal to 5 is a little over 3% of GDP, so it's twice, just prenatal to 5 alone is twice the size of the American auto industry. The fourth area of inquiry was, as I mentioned, was finance, and this is this conference call today is an outgrowth of that. The fifth was advocacy, and within the area of advocacy, the Partnership for America's Economic Success, after 3 years of research gathering, decided to focus on business advocacy. That is to work with the business community to understand the economic growth and job creation, workforce competitiveness effects of investing in kids prenatal to five in effective ways. Affiliation with the Pew Charitable Trust ended this past year, and the partnership, that the whole operation moved to America's Promise Alliance, which is where this work was done in conjunction with the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City. So as I mentioned at the outset of the call, I'm one of the co-directors of the Human Capital and Economic Opportunity Global Working Group with Jim Heckman and Steve Derloff at the University of Wisconsin, Jim at the University of Chicago. That working group is now north of 280 people worldwide and is conducting research in a wide range of areas, everything from health to identity, inequality, and philosophy of inequality. And one of the working groups is on marketing and finance, And this project, that working group is chaired by Lance Locker in Canada. This project fits into that subgroup's subject area, and so this conference call is effectively a conference call of the subgroup on finance and markets of the Human Capital and Economic Opportunity Global Working Group. Now, I'm hoping by now we've gotten everybody on the call. Again, my name is Rob Duggar. I'm in Washington, D.C. We will be looking at a presentation that you have the links for. The presentation is called Social Impact, Pay for Success, Finance, a Pixie Bond Example. And I will be flipping through this. We've got plenty of time, but what I'll try to do is get through the presentation in fairly quick order to maximize the amount of time for questions. And then that way we can make progress and get the – this is a fairly technical subject. There's a lot of complexity to it. So the more thoroughly we can all understand it, the better. So first of all, let's go to the first page. If any of you need information on where to get this, if you'd kindly just take your phone off mute and let me know, or perhaps I could just tell you. There are two places, the Human Capital and Economic Opportunity Working Group website, and that's the email information you got. It's also available on the ReadyNation.org website under the Kaufman ReadyNation tab over on the right-hand side of that web page. So the first thing is that slide two, education is being cut. At the same time, an educated workforce is the need for it is clearer than ever. Slide three, social impact finance is designed to capture the intersection of for-profit and not-for-profit investor incentives. As you can see, there's a financial return floor below which for-profit investors are not very interested. I should say that's a risk return floor. And there's a social return floor below which philanthropic investors are not interested in. And the idea is to have an area where those two incentive sectors intersect and see if you can design finance for that sectors. The Pixie Bond program that we're going to describe captures the difference between the return on preschool and the return on K-12 schooling, using as a kind of motivating image the now famous slide or chart of Jim Heckman's skill formation in economics investing in disadvantaged children, where you can see very clearly the returns for investing in kids in the earliest years of their lives is much higher than later years, and we are attempting to capture that difference in this financing model. Pixie Bonds, slide five, provide a triple bottom line to investors as a societal return in that the very formation of a Pixie program creates a coalition of business leaders who understand which programs work and who can shape state and federal policy. There are obvious economic returns resulting from higher third grade reading and math scores, higher graduation rates, and all the other benefits that are associated with quality early learning. There's a financial benefit, competitive interest rates, principal repayment, savings as a percent of philanthropic investment in present value terms, almost 100%. Satisfying from a philanthropic standpoint. The Kaufman Ready Nation Working Group, which was formed about 3 years ago in a partnership between, with the help of Bob Lighten and my, and he and I sort of co-chair this working group. That working group has effectively concluded in general that social impact bonds can reduce pressure on state and federal budgets, improve early child development and education, and increase K-12 education productivity and eventual workforce competitiveness. Looking at slide seven, we get to the actual sort of mechanics of social impact bonds. There is in the center, a bond issuing organization, And that bond issuing organization provides payments to service providers. The service providers engage in an activity which reduces the operations of some form of government, some government operation. The savings are then paid back to the bond issuing organization, and the bond issuing organization repays the invested capital and interest to private investors. Pixie bonds are a kind of social impact bond. And in this instance, the social impact bond is used to pay for quality pre-kindergarten to reduce special education costs of public school systems. It involves regional business leaders and philanthropists, Pixie bond buyers, state governments, school districts, and the Pixie bond issuer itself, an organization. In order for Pixie bonds to have attractiveness to the market, there has to be strong state and local business and philanthropic support. In other words, no third-party bond investor is going to buy bonds in a buy the bonds so to speak, capital partnership, an early learning capital partnership, unless it sees that the local community, state, and other institutions all support this general idea. The second is it needs to have rigorous statistical demonstrations of projected benefits. As we get into this in a bit, you're going to see that this is the crux of the whole matter, because the statistical studies that underlie the projected savings also calibrate the contract between the bond issuing organization and the school system. These next two check marks relate to that. There has to be sound legal foundation for the Pixie bond issuing organization itself, and clear enforceable contracts between the Pixie participating entities, and particularly between the bond issuing organization and the school districts. Bonds should have familiar terms. The less unique or distinctive the bonds are, the less marketability they have, the more sort of plain vanilla they are, the better. They also, of course, ultimately would need to have good working relationships with the investing, underwriting, institutional foundation, investor sectors. As those of you on this call no doubt know, there are really three kinds of studies that are done in early care, early child development, and education: the randomized control trials, case control trials, and statistical projection trials. All of these trials of various kinds show that quality pre-kindergarten is associated with significant reductions in special education costs, as much as 50% or more. But clearly, as you go down this list, randomized control trials give you the highest confidence. Case control trials, where you're comparing two groups, but it isn't a randomized selection process, provide some confidence, but not the kind of certainty that randomized control trials do. And the last statistical projection trials are those such as the Pennsylvania pre-K count study, on which we rely heavily, looks at the students in the program, and based on past experience or of kids of social economic characteristics in general, they are assigned to special ed at a rate of 18%, but the pre-K counts program, based on the testing of the students when they graduate from the pre-K counts program, are projected to be assigned at a 2.5% rate. This isn't an actual assignment rate. What needs to happen for the pre-K count study to be an actual assignment rate they need to actually track the graduates of the pre-K count program, and confirm that the special ed assignment rates are indeed materially lower than they would have been without the program. But that's work that has to be done ultimately in each jurisdiction because every jurisdiction has different demographic and economic and employment and economic industry conditions that would affect special ed assignment rates in that area. And accordingly, this is a very PCC bond issuance is a very localized process. Okay, let's take a look at slide 11. What we're going to do is show a sample program where we provide scholarships for 100 pre-K students per year. Each year is one financing round. Over 10 years, we're providing pre-K services for about 1,000 children. Now let's just look quickly at the overview of statistical projection trials. What you see there is the Pennsylvania pre-K counts, 10,000 students. This is just a summary of it. The children exceeded kindergarten transition skills, BSSI-3 tests, spoken language, and other tests. The projected pre-K count special education placement rate was 2.4%, significantly lower than the 18% historical special ed placement rate of Pennsylvania area school districts. So we use those relationships, 18%, but what we do is we assume for just the sake of discussion that the actual assignment rate for pre-K counts students is not 2.4%, but actually 3.5%. We use a number about three times their projected rate. Using data from the third largest school district in Pennsylvania, data from the Bethlehem Area School District, on page 13, the cost of the pre-K counts program is equal to $7,850 per year. The cost of special ed per child per year is $12,141. That's directly from their data. And we assume also that pre-K quality preschool does not address all the disabilities that cause a child to be assigned to special education. In fact, we estimate that it actually addresses only about 70% of the disabilities. There are disabilities such as blindness, autism, deafness, and others that, while it might be helped by qualities preschool, it's actually not. It does not reduce their assignment to special education. So we use a amelioration rate of 70%, and so we get a special ed cost adjusted by the amelioration rate of $8,499. The number of years in special ed we based on the national distribution. Generally, when children enter special ed, they do it in the first 3 years in kindergarten, first grade, or second grade. Generally, when learning disabilities that are going to result in public school assignment, special ed assignment occurs, and generally it appears that roughly on average they're in special ed for about 8 or 9 years. In the high school years, there's the participation special ed drops very rapidly in the final 3 years, mainly because of high school dropouts. And we also assume that there's migration out of the school district. This is extremely important. If you provide scholarships for kids and you have a contract with the school district, and the school district is going to share the special ed savings with the provider, then we would expect that if children leave the area, you've made the investment, but you don't get the special ed savings, and so there's a loss there. We put in a migration rate out of the school district of 2%. This is since we're focusing this next project on Northern Virginia. This is the estimate of a migration out of the seven counties of Northern Virginia. For the most part, people are moving into those counties and not out. But within the counties, there's a lot of movement. So you can have upwards of 10 to 20% of kids with quality preschool programs leaving one county and going to another county. So whatever you do in Northern Virginia has to involve all the counties. The discount rate we use is roughly twice the discount rate used in most studies. We use 5%, well above the sort of usual social discount rates, and we do that because this program is more of a capital investment kind of project rather than a government program. It is not truly a venture capital kind of enterprise in which the discount rates might be as high as 20%. But we thought 5% was a kind of conservative number, which begins to put this in the proper risk context for from an investor standpoint. You can see here on slide 14 the distribution of the number of children receiving special education based on a nationwide data. That you can also see a chart of the disabilities covered quality preschool. In general, we're starting with, I'm going to go through these next pages. It's fairly kind of a grinding detail process, but I'll go through it quickly, but because having these numbers in mind when we come to look at the performance charts helps understand them. We're starting off the program with 53-year-olds and 54-year-olds. That's 100 children. We assume that the setting up a school readiness capital partnership costs about $500,000. It's paid out over 3 years. The mentoring per child is $1,000 a year. That is the person who goes and works with the parents of the child and helps them select the best preschool for their child. There's a PC graduate monitoring. The children are monitored by the School Readiness Capital Partnership throughout elementary school, and ideally they would be monitored for many years afterwards. The business leader philanthropists pay for the setup and operating costs, and they are not repaid. This is an outright philanthropic grant. This is one of the features which gives bond investors confidence that this is a serious program and that people see the advantages and benefits of doing this. There are special ed cost savings, and that's the difference between the special ed costs with and without PCSE, the pre-K, PKSE program. Special ed cost savings rate, we assume that as savings are accumulated, they can be invested each year at 3%. The bonds are straight 10-year bonds, simple bonds. They pay 3%, and the bond repayment is paid for out of accumulated savings gains. There's a group of philanthropists called PRI philanthropists. They are project-related investment philanthropists. As you'll see when we get into the actual workings of the model, you'll see this period when the bonds come due that the model goes cash flow negative. In order to smooth that out, there are a lot of ways to smooth that out, but what we did is to build in this project-related investment concept to the program. If the project-related investors are Kellogg Foundation or Gates Foundation or any foundation that is looking at these processes very carefully, the fact that that a foundation like Gates or Kellogg or someone like that buys these project-related investment bonds indicates that the PCSE program, in a sense, meets basic best practices standards. The length of the program financing round, 2 years for three-year-olds and 1 year for four-year-olds, is 13 years throughout. I think that, these next block of things on page 18 are clear enough. On page 19, we begin to see the performance characteristics of PCSE bond program. In the first year, there are 100 three- and four-year-olds who enter the program, and as they graduate, you see the green line, triangle line going up, and it drops steadily. That reflects the 2% outward migration, and then it falls at the end of the 15th year, when the last of the children graduates from high school. The number of children in special ed with and without the PCSE program is shown on page 20. There we can see the triangle blue line is the total of all children in K through 12. The square red line is the children without PC scholarships, and the green line is the number of children in special ed with PC scholarships. Sources and uses of funds is shown on page 21. We can see that the regional philanthropists have to come up outright with $50,000, and they expend that over the first 3 years. Thereafter, there is a small regional philanthropy commitment, which is equal to the monitoring process, monitoring expense, which I mentioned before. Pixie bond investors put in about $550,000, and that pays for the scholarships for the first 100 kids. After the third year, their contribution is zero. The state government, we assume, has a role. In Virginia, it does, and it does in many other states. For example, the PK accounts program is paid for by the state in Pennsylvania. The Virginia program is a match for four-year-olds, and we built one in. This is a state government match for the second year of the PC program. They pay half the PC scholarship cost. As you can see, there's a page 22 shows the performance of the first round of PC financing. As you can see, the blue diamond line, the cumulative special ed savings gains, and they steadily grow over the years. The PC bond payment, there's a bump in the 10th year when the bonds are paid off. They're paid off in two tranches. Remember that the bonds are paying for three-year-olds and then four-year-olds, and in the second year, there's a smaller total amount of capital that needs to be invested. So there's a tranche of bonds that are 11 years that mature in the 11th year. So you have 10, you have payments in the 10th year and the 11th year, and that draws down the cumulative savings, which are shown by the diamond green line, funds available for future financing rounds. It draws down and actually makes it go negative. How do you deal with that negative cash flow? That is dealt with in this model by PRI contributions to deal with the negative cash flow. In this chart on page 23, we have philanthropic PRIs, which is the X blue line. There's an initial philanthropic contribution in the very beginning of the process because there's a slight cash flow negativity in the first year, and then there's a bump up in the 10th and 11th years when the bonds are paid off. The philanthropic PRIs provide the sort of third-party affirmation that the PC program is on the level in the early years, and then it bridges the cash flow negative phase in the 10th and 11th year. The key idea here is that when you look at let's go back to page 22, you can see that what we're attempting to do in each one of these financing rounds is to maximize the amount of money that's available for future financing rounds. When you have philanthropic PRIs, you get a situation in which you get a fairly significant funds available for the next financing round. And this is on page 24. We've taken a whole series of these financing rounds and done present value comparisons of the different components of it. Let's look at the first one. The tall, dark first bar is the present value of PXE special education cost savings gains. The next bar is the present value of PXE bond interest and repayment. This is the what all the bond holders put in. The third mid-gray bar is the present value of savings gains available for future rounds. And you recall that because of the absence of PRIs in this, there's very little money that's available to be invested into the second round. And the light bar shows the amount of investment, total present value of the investment of the philanthropic contributions. As you can see in the second round, even though there was relatively little money generated in that first round for reinvestment in the second round. There is a slight gain and movement towards complete sustainability. What we're by sustainability, we mean that the amount of money needed from Pixie bond purchasers is steadily falling, and we can see that in comparing round 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. We can see that the second bar from the left, the light gray bar next to the dark black bar, that bar is steadily falling over time, and that's indicating that the amount of money needed to be borrowed from outside private sector borrowers is steadily declining. And when we get to the year 5 and beyond, we can see that the amount of savings gains is enough to finance the program entirely. There's no need for outside Pixie bond investors, and there's also no need for local philanthropic contributions. Now, in this particular presentation, the parameters of it achieve sustainability in the 5th year, 60 months out. 65 years, while there are many investors who would like to who like the program and would wait that long, the risks of a 5-year horizon are psychologically materially greater than a 3-year horizon, and the absence of PRI or a sort of third-party Gates Foundation-type affirmation of the program manifesting best practices would probably make it very hard to sell those bonds. So it's better to offer a program which works with major philanthropic entities and do it with PRIs, and what you can see on page 25. These PRIs, this reaches sustainability very quickly. It achieves it in 36 to 48 months. The next couple of slides show you what happens when the assignment rates exceed the tolerances. We see that the program does not achieve sustainability at all. And the last is a series of charts which shows the performance of the program when we use the pre-K counts 10,000 child survey projection of 2.4%. As you can see, it's phenomenally financially successful. It achieves sustainability in 36 months. It's really quite impressive, but our sense is that from an actual operational standpoint, the amounts of uncertainties associated with individual local studies is such that it may prove to be the case that reductions in special ed assignments of at-risk kids can be reduced from 18% to 2.5%. But it's more likely that 18% to 7.5% is a better number to go into the discussions with. So we, in this study, use 7.5%. So I will stop there and open it up for questions. I think that I don't know exactly how to do this, but if you would kindly just give your name and affiliation, ask your question, I'll respond, and we'll just keep going until the various issues have been dealt with, if that would be convenient for people. Are there any questions or comments or guidance?
Hey, Rob, this is Lance Lockman.
Please go ahead.
Hey, Lance, go ahead. You're co-chair of this thing.
I didn't even know that.
Yes. Well, you're chair of the markets.
That's true. That's true. Christina sends her regards. She's is tied up in talks today.
Okay.
I have a question about your numbers for the reductions in PCC or the reductions in special ed are all based on Pennsylvania numbers. And
yes.
Do you know what do you have similar rate? I mean, the big question, I guess, is do you have similar rates of special ed of 15-20% in Virginia where you're planning on moving in with this in Alexandria, or
we do, as a matter of fact, as a kind of preliminary matter. But when we look at one program, the Child and Family Network Center's program in Alexandria, which is the one we are doing a longitudinal study, it's not a projection study. The Pennsylvania study is a projection study. Pennsylvania actually needs, in fact, Bethlehem area school district, if it were to set up a PC bond program for Lehigh Valley, would need to do a longitudinal study of the graduates of the Bethlehem Area School District pre-K counts program. They would have to track them into the elementary school and see if indeed the rate of special ed assignment drops is materially different from the rate of special ed assignment for other children similarly economically, socially situated in that region. As you know from the paper is 80 pages long. This PowerPoint presentation necessarily has to cover, you know, skip an awful lot of details. But in the paper, we describe the school district of Bethlehem area school district. There are 15,000 children that are free and reduced lunch children who would qualify to be in the pre-K counts program. But state budgets permit participation of those children, only about 500 to 600 of those 15,000 children can participate in the pre-K counts program. So it could quite clearly be increased significantly. Now the question for the Bethlehem Area School District is: let's look at the 14,000 children who are not in the program and see what the assignment rate is. Is it based on the study, pre-K count study, done by the Heinz Foundation, the assignment rate is probably, you know, 15 to 20%. And if pre-K counts has the effectiveness that the study finds, then the assignment rate of pre-K counts graduates in the Bethlehem Area School District special ed program will be south of 5%. Let's say 2.5%. And that would be a financially very, very viable program. But they have to actually track both categories of kids, the 14,000 or so that do not get any pre-K at all, and the 500 to 600, upwards of 1,000, to take a couple of years of kids and look at them over several cohorts. Compare their assignment rates to see if indeed, in actuality, there is a difference that is enough to sustain a PC bond program. And that study is the kind of study that we're doing in Alexandria.
Okay. One thing I have a question about, or I'm curious about, is that, I mean, so all the savings is going to come from reduction. Or the savings you're relying on is the reduction in special ed. Is there a sense? Do you have a good sense in which? I mean, presumably that means essentially firing a bunch of special ed teachers. Is there a sense or concern that short run or in the first few years it's hard for these districts to do that, or is that a fairly easy thing to do?
Well, the PC programs will crawl before they walk, and they'll walk before they run. In Bethlehem Area School District, if you were to introduce a PC program of the sort we've described, you'd be adding to the number of children who are in the pre-K counts program by 100. You would be reducing the number of children at this point. Looking at 15,000 children, take 18% of that, and that's the number of children that are being assigned to special education in this very large two-county Lehigh Valley geographic area. That's a lot of kids, and you're going to be reducing the number of kids from 18 to, let's say, 7.5, as we described, so you're reducing them by about 11 kids. That's not going to affect the special education budget in its total, in its large dimensions, really at all. It won't affect the budget in a material way until you're running PC bond programs involving thousands of kids. If you crawl, then you walk, and then you run, probably the natural attrition that comes from special ed teachers retiring or changing work, or they may see the numbers and realize that actually there's their life purpose is better achieved by being solid pre-K teachers than special ed teachers. And if indeed we're reallocating capital to the earlier years, the demand for pre-K teachers is going to go up. Mm-hmm. And there will be positions for special ed teachers. That these are obviously teachers who are quite skilled and could almost certainly qualify to be good preschool teachers, and therefore it would be a rotation out of remediation and then into providing the children the education and social skills and other capabilities that the kids need before they get to school.
Right.
So I've had some extensive discussions here in Virginia with the special ed community, and they are telling me, gee, if this works, this is not a problem for them. They would love to see this happen. And one of the reassurances they find from it is that it's very much a crawl, then a walk, and then a run. It would take, you know, clearly, if you were to be doing this on a serious basis in a school district like the one we have identified, the Bethlehem Area School District, you'd be doing a couple of years of 100 kids, and then you'd be doing a couple of years at, say, 200 kids, and you'd be slowly building it up. It might not be the confidence level for the region, the business community, the philanthropic community, the financial community, the confidence level in the whole project to be dealing with, bringing in 1,000 kids a year. Probably take 5 to 7 to 8 years for that to happen.
Right. Okay.
So politically, we don't sense resistance.
Hi, Rob. This is Elizabeth Gruginski with United Way Worldwide.
Hi.
The presentation, and we've been looking at this. So a couple questions from kind of the investor standpoint. I think you said that, you know, 3 and 5 years out is about all the risk you felt was tenable within the system, but thinking of true investments and capital bonds, those are usually 10 to 15 years. So,
yes.
And we know the return on investment of those birth to three with the investment in evidence-based home visitation and early Head Start. What are there conversations around actually being able to capture that piece up through third grade and looking at even remediation as a cost savings as well as special ed? I think with that, I mean, and you all have done such great research on that piece of the brain development and what's happening in those first 3 years, that there could really be a lot of cost savings captured if we extend that time and extend the investment period out.
You're absolutely right, and I think that when we're having these conversations 5 to 7 years from now, I personally think that this is a viable financial strategy.
Yes.
I think that whether you call them LE bonds, early learning impact bonds, or whether you call them PCE bonds or whatever you call them, doesn't really matter. They have the potential, if done properly from the beginning, with the right kind of statistical foundations, the right kind of seriousness of purpose, they could be for early care and early education what mortgages were to housing. Obviously, mortgages are 30-year instruments. They tend to roll over every 7 to 8 years, but people buy 30-year instruments, they buy 10-year bonds, they buy 30-year bonds, they buy 10 and 15-year bridge bonds. So the time period is not so much the issue. It's the, so to speak, the collateral. And in the problem with PCE bonds is the collateral kind of walks out the door. So it needs to be captured fairly quickly. And for that reason, ideally, it should be captured pretty conclusively within the first 24 to 36 months whether you've got a winner. And with PCE bonds, you're going to know that because you're going to see a reduced special education assignment rate in kindergarten, first grade, or second grade, and that's going to give you the confidence that you've got a viable program or not.
Right.
The I am very excited. In fact, one of the next study, there are two or three next studies. One of the next studies, obviously, is the Northern Virginia project. The other project is a nurse family partnership, and the gains there may be very high within the first few months. I mean, literally within a year, within 12 months. Within 12 months, you will know whether the prenatal care you've established with nurse family partnership actually results in higher healthy baby deliveries. And
or also reduction of child abuse.
Yep.
Possibly.
Oh, absolutely. But the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to have lower Medicaid delivery costs. And then you're going to have lower criminal justice costs, social welfare costs associated with abuse and neglect. That's all going to show up within 12 to – but what's so exciting about nurse-family partnership is that the medical costs associated with low birth weight babies are so high. It may work. The program may be viable just effectively on that alone. And so then that what the advantage of that is that you reduce the number of agencies with which you have to with you have a contract. Now keep in mind the way social impact bonds work. A group of investors provides funds to a group of providers who provide services which reduced government costs. And there's a contract between the investor group and the government that says the government will take the savings and rebate it back to the investor group so the investor group can take the savings and pay off the bonds. A problem with nurse family partnership in general is that it appears to involve a lot of agencies, federal agencies for Medicare, state agencies for CHIPS, a variety of state agencies for child welfare and criminal justice costs. There's at least four or five areas of agencies that are involved, and it's all their costs that you're attempting to reduce. And therefore, just structuring that social impact bond contract, the rebate contract, so that each agency knows exactly the amount of money it writes a check for to payable to the social impact bond issuer. That's the toughest part of social impact bond design.
Exactly.
And it's for that reason that we picked special ed as our initial project, because it involves only one agency, a school district. And if you can get the state level, state government and legislature to pass some legislation which kind of gives a laying on, a blessing, state blessing on the whole idea, that makes it easier. But the fundamental contract is between a local school readiness capital partnership and a local school district. Those are only two entities. And the contract specifies in careful detail exactly the amount of money that the school district writes, the number the school district writes on the check that it hands to the social impact bond issuer to use to service the debt. So there's only one. That's the simplicity of it. But prenatal, actually, conception to age three has got economic returns that are so high that if you can solve the agency problem, and I think you can, frankly, especially if Pixie bonds work and people sort of see how it works, it should not be a problem to get state authorities to pass legislation which effectively authorizes and or directs agencies to work with a conception to age three community of social impact bond investors.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Stephen Durloff, hi.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. So yeah, I want to ask a couple of grumbly economist questions.
Please. You asked a couple of them in comments on the paper, and they were very, very helpful.
So one question actually has to do with the political economy, and that is a concern that the success of a a program of this type would crowd out other government spending on early childhood. I don't know if you've thought about that. And I guess the second issue is, really the question is how to sort of ensure that that the school district or county or whatever level of aggregation entities don't reduce their investments in response to the existence of this new channel of funds. The second question had to do with the endogeneity, shall we say, of some of the objects that you use for your calculations. So just to give one example, have you thought about whether or not the migration rate would increase if one of these programs was in place? I could tell you a story as to why that would happen, but
you don't have to tell us a story. We know it increases.
Okay.
Yeah, we know it increases. The minute a struggling low-income parents get a scholarship for their child to go to a quality preschool, the whole family's outlook changes. The mentor shows up at the front door. The mentor begins to explain the opportunities and the benefits for the child and the need for the parents to become involved and all of that. Their life attitudes change, and because in effect society has changed its relationship with them. And they might feel more attached to the locale that provided the scholarship, but because of their improved sense of belonging in the society, they may look for higher-paying work wherever they can find it. And to keep them in the school district, you may need to have a contract with the parents which requires them to stay. We think that a better solution is to get state law passed, which requires any school that receives one of these children to rebate to the original school readiness capital partnership some estimate of the special education savings. So then basically the state is calculating special education savings on a statewide basis and making sure that wherever these kids go, the rebates go back to the capital partnerships that finance them in the first place, and in order to give them the proper and strong incentive to set up these things. But if you don't have a sort of state cross school district rebating agreements or state law that requires it, then you have to set up the school readiness capital partnership in a large enough geographic area where outward migration is low enough. And for Northern Virginia, this means you've got to have seven counties. And it's as big as most states.
I mean, because you actually brought up something. Yeah, I mean, you brought up something that's fascinating, which is the effect on the parents, which is of first order importance.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it all the more hard to calculate the benefits of the program.
Yes.
So I actually find that a bit of an irony.
Yeah, this was a problem that Steve Bartik wrestled with extensively in his book on regional economic development. And the development effects are actually they're material. That is, you're almost certainly going to increase the productivity of the parents. And that's a benefit that's not calculated in this. Another benefit that's not calculated in this, but which certainly should be included in any PC bond contract, is the parental involvement from age three on probably means, and the improved school readiness, probably means that grade retention is going to drop. In fact, we know from all the studies that grade retention does mm-hmm. appear to drop significantly. And in Northern Virginia, where we have very large, the Alexander School System has 80-some languages spoken in its hallways. So English language learner cost will decline. So that is the cost the school has to pay in order to get kindergarten, first grade, second grade kids able to learn in English. That cost can be reduced. It's not as important a cost as grade retention, certainly not as important a cost as special ed, but it should be thrown into the pot in order to properly calculate the total returns. But we don't know, because if you one of the reasons the Alexandria School District is very interested in this is that if you reduce their special education costs and improve the quality of the kids that are going into the school, the first, you know, third, fourth grade, they get better math and reading scores. But what they're really looking at is if the benefits are large enough, can they work out an agreement with the capital partnership where they pay only, say, 70% of the special ed savings? If that 70% of the special ed savings is enough to finance the debt, then they have 30% additional budget resource, 30% of the special ed budget, which is huge, 30% of the special ed budget, which they can allocate in the high school years to improve what all the businesses want, which is STEM education. All the businesses want, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and they can allocate more resources at the middle school and high school level for these things, and this keeps the business community happy. What is very important then in terms of political economy, the business community looking at the total project may be relatively uninterested in what happens in the first 3 to 5 years of the child's experience in the public school system, but it's very interested in what happens in the final 6 years.
Right.
And it sees by helping at the first few years, it frees up resources for the later years, and that draws the business community into the early childhood, being willing to support this process. Mm-hmm. But what's your other grumbly question? There's a couple of other ways.
It was the crowding out concern that I had, that districts would use this as an excuse to cut other funding.
Oh, yes. You could imagine that, let's say, particularly you see it with the possibility of the nurse-family partnership kinds of things, where a community is spending X on child welfare costs to deal with child abuse and neglect.
Mm-hmm.
And a social impact bond community forms, they raise money, they provide increase home visitation type services on a significant scale, and it reduces the social welfare costs. Well, what we can see is that what we've shifted is from corrective expenses to nurturing and parenting expenses. We've increased the society's investment in those areas. We've reduced them elsewhere. And where the crowding out might occur is that the state itself ceases to provide state paid for home visitation services. That's the kind of thing you'd be concerned about. That's where the state legislature really needs to be involved. We didn't discuss that in the paper. I didn't really actually understand it, and I still don't understand the kind of how to structure state legislation to reduce the probability that, say, that the county of Fairfax, which now provides home visitation services, but if you set up this program and it begins to provide home visitation services, will the county cut back, and then the net result be that you haven't really affected savings in the community at all? You haven't actually reduced social welfare costs at all in the community. And in that instance, there'd have to be some netting out. In other words, if the county reduced its own provision of those services, and the result was that the benefit reduced spending on child and abuse and neglect expenditures was not obtained, and therefore the program would fail, then you'd have to have something that prevents that in the contract or in the state law. I agree with you.
Yeah. So I God's in the details and all these things, so it's kind of unfair at this level of abstraction to be asking all these questions about.
It's not unfair. It's got to. These things have to work on the ground.
Yeah.
They have to. All these questions need to be asked in advance.
Yeah.
Good questions.
Fair enough. Okay.
Rob.
Yes.
Hi, this is Horacio Tenacia from UCL in London. And I have a couple of questions which are quite related to Steve's first question. So as he said, you know, the whole idea, which I find fascinating and great, lives on the ability to capture this, well, first of all, these returns to materialize and then being able to capture the within the horizon of the bond.
Mm-hmm.
And then you rightly said in your presentation at some point that it's crucial to have a sound statistical evidence that where these returns are, and probably, you know, the effect that you can get on special education needs by having a quality preschool depends very much on the specific of the intervention. And moreover, one would think that, first of all, I think it would be extremely useful to have some, for a concrete intervention, some sound evidence on its impact. And B, to worry about that, you know, if you do a small randomized trial, maybe on 100 kids or so, you might have certain measurable effects. Once you think of the program at scale, those effects can be very different. It might be mm-hmm. much harder to get the same impact at scale, both because it becomes much harder to run a program of a large scale, and because of you can have all sorts of effects, maybe the migration stuff, but also others in terms of crowding, in terms of whatever. So I was wondering whether, A, you thought about these issues, about how to gather the necessary evidence on the impacts, and B, how does the assignment of kids to these programs would work?
These are all very good questions. Let me talk about the first one. Yes. Thanks to people like Jim Heckman and Steve Thurloff, and frankly, a healthy army of others, a lot of these things have been thought about because the sort of careful thinkers are working on this, and it needs to be done extremely carefully. As far as the data is concerned, we find in Northern Virginia that as a result of the No Child Left Behind Act, most children coming into kindergarten are given an entrance interview. And that interview covers a lot of detail about the child's previous health and education and social and economic circumstances. So when the child enters kindergarten, there's a sort of benchmark interview set of results which indicate just where the child stands in a kind of in an economic sense. The child's information year by year is then kept within the school. The study that we're doing in Alexandria is, as you rightly pointed out, you can't just use any study and base a PIXE bond or social impact bond program on the generality of studies. It has to be a study that is specific to a particular curriculum. And what we're studying is the performance of the Elmira, Michigan, this is the sort of the great-great-grandchild of Perry, the Elmira curriculum, followed by the Child and Family Network Centers in Alexandria, Virginia. And there's just, as you know, there are many Child and Family Network Centers schools around the preschools around the country, but the ones that we're looking at is just the one that is offered in Alexandria. And we're tracking kids going back 3 years of all the graduates of the program, and then we're tracking the graduates through grade five to see what their special education assignment rates are, what their grade retention, and what their English language learner costs are, and what their third and fourth grade reading and math scores are, because we want to get a sense of, you know, academic or cognitive impact as well as cost reduction impact. So we're gathering that sort of information on 600 to 700 kids in three cohorts as they move through the school district, comparing them to the entirety of all other children in the Alexander school system who are comparably situated. Now, you mentioned endogeneity. Steve mentioned endogeneity. Let me mention endogeneity. And you ask about selection. Children are selected at random into the Child and Family Network centers. There are not enough center placements, slots, for all the children who want to go and who are qualified to go because it is a Title I low-income program. It only accepts low-income kids. There are hundreds of applicants. They can only accept maybe thousands of applicants, but they only accept 100 or so at a time. We know that the applicants are children of motivated parents. We suspect, and those are the applicants that get accepted. And we know that the applicants are children of motivated parents. And we suspect that the parents who did not apply are either not motivated or didn't know or something. But because a parental attitude matters so much, or parental involvement in a child's education matters so much, we suspect strongly that in addition to looking at the kids who are accepted into the program, we need to make sure that there's no material difference between the applicants who got accepted and the applicants who didn't get accepted. And that's a separate study. Thirdly, what we expect is that if you expand the number of Child and Family Network Centers slots by 100 a year, which is quite significant, you will be affecting the communities from which these children come. There will be mentors going into these communities, which are these mentors are very much like home visitation staff. They go into these communities and they visit with the family that's been accepted into the program. They talk with the families about what their child needs and so forth. And more than likely, the parents of children who did not get accepted into the program are going to be talking with the parents of children who did. And they're going to be finding out, what books are you reading? What are the children doing? What do the mentors say? What are they saying about diet? What are they saying about what books I should read to the child at night? What are they saying? And this is affecting the quality of parenting that is provided to kids who are not in the program. It may not be a large effect in the beginning, but it could very well be a significant effect over time. And that will have to be monitored also. One of the experts in special education is pointing to this demonstration effect as a reason for why nationally special education assignment rates are coming down slightly, and they have been coming down for 4 or 5 years. Even before the downturn, they started coming down. And that this may be the result of cumulative effects of the broad range of programs offered from conception to age 5, the effect of IDEA Part C and Part D, which pick up children with disabilities literally from birth, that all these effects are accumulating in at-risk communities and yielding us children who are slightly, on average, better prepared for school than they were in the previous several years. So this endogeneity of accepted children and their parents' impact on non-accepted children and their parents is something that has to be watched. It's a subtle effect, but it has to be watched.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Hello?
Yes, right here.
This is Valerie over at the University of Chicago, and actually a group of us master's students are working on a social impact bond practicum right now.
Oh, cool.
And I was wondering, it's later on, it's on teen pregnancy prevention, but something we grapple with is where to trace these costs back to, and we're trying to clarify, and if you could speak to how you can clarify on the decreasing special ed expenditures of the school district and how they're related to changes in the revenues of the school district that may be coming from state or federal sources. So the assumption right now that we have is that, you know, the federal grant money is coming to school districts for students based on the number of kids in special education, that it's a per capita type of grant. So if the number of kids in the special education program decreases and the money spent by the school district decreases, how does that offset, or how does the federal grant money how is that affected by that?
Well, it's actually not affected at all. The IDEA Part B, which covers special education costs, only covers about 7% of total special education costs in a public school. The effect of IDEA is to provide a nationwide framework for disabilities, laws affecting disabilities, and the, in some respects, more important Part B, which picks up kids with disabilities from age 3. The federal money effectively creates special education resources for children as early as age 3. It's when they enter kindergarten that they become beneficiaries of the state-provided, school district-provided special education services, which are measurable in the tens, elevens of, you know, $12,000 a year. The money included in these Pixie bonds, and I guess I think we tried to address this in the paper itself, where we talk about the history and the operation of special education, but maybe we didn't do it clearly enough to point out that the special education cost savings that we're talking about in this program arise only from the reduction in state public school budgeted spending.
Oh, okay.
There's no the federal statute has a maintenance of effort requirement. It calls it MOE,
mm-hmm.
And only under very special circumstances can you actually reduce the amount of money that you spend on special education from one year to the next. So one small benefit is that if you reduce the amount of money a school district is spending on special education, it would arguably continue to spend special education federal dollars, and perhaps those federal dollars would go further to meeting its special education budget, because you couldn't actually reduce the amount of money the federal government is providing. It's actually very complicated, and I just, in this answer to you, I did not handle it well. You're quite right. The federal money is on the basis of per capita. If you reduce the number of kids that are assigned the special, the federal money should go down. But then there's all kinds of permissions the school has to get to show that indeed this is happening and their maintenance of effort can be reduced. As a consequence, we've not taken into consideration any federal money in these examples.
It's a problem which
we've been told by the Department of Education, HEW, that if we can show that this has the effects that we're talking about, they will take up the question of granting waivers for school readiness capital partnership financed early childhood interventions, which is a permissible way to reduce the maintenance of effort under IDEA Part B.
Thankful.
Is that responsive, Valerie?
Oh, no, it was very helpful. I mean, I think that a lot of the things that we're looking at right now are so the funding and the sources come from so many different areas and parts of the government that we are having a difficult time tracing out right now because we deal with so many different agencies.
Yeah, I'm going to suggest, Valerie, that our experience indicates that if you have multiple agencies, you've got to have multiple contracts. And the heart, literally the spinal cord, of a social impact bond operation is the contract. If you can't write those contracts, you can't have a program. It's extremely important to keep in mind there are hundreds of programs with high economic returns, but there are very few programs around which you can build a contract and get a government agency to sign it. because that government agency's got to write a check, and the check has to be accurate to the penny. And that contract has to be written so it tells them exactly to the penny the number, the amount of money on that check. And when you keep your mind on the contract, what you'll very quickly do is look for programs that have only one or two, and maybe at most three agencies. If you have multiple agencies, you've increased the difficulty of setting up a social impact bond program. Certainly, it's sort of at this early stage of financial market experience with the institution. You've made it immensely more difficult. It might be that years from now, after everybody's kind of familiar with them, you can sort of bundle these things together and get multiple contracts with different agencies bundled together, and everybody's comfortable about it, and they're willing to offer the bonds, and everything just goes swimmingly. But for now, getting people to buy bonds or getting a bank to make a loan based on a contract with multiple agencies could be very difficult.
Right. And in your experience with other states, I mean, we are specifically looking at the state of Illinois and looking at how nonprofits are able to issue bonds through government conduits. And so this is speaking a little bit more to the regulations surrounding it, but would each state have to establish some sort of like IFA or IDA agency to be able to issue these bonds, and would these be specific statutes, or would it be able to go underneath just a general like umbrella of, you know, whatever development agencies are currently existing?
The PCC bonds are not issued by an agency. That's an important feature. Social impact bonds are issued by a public-private partnership of some kind.
Right.
But in order for it to probably truly succeed, it needs to be, in essence, like a mortgage. A mortgage is issued by a homeowner, and the house is the collateral. And the federal government provides a framework, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, which makes for uniform mortgages. Mortgages all look the same. A state can have a federal statute, and it can even have an agency, which in essence kind of gives a good housekeeping seal of approval on the bonds. But the bonds ultimately have to be secured by the contract that garners the savings from the reduction in cost that the agency benefits from. It's those reduction in costs that have to be defined by the contract with sufficient clarity that the agency at the end of the year knows exactly to the penny how big the check should be that's paid to the social impact bond issuer, and the issuer uses that money to service the debt. If nonprofits are issuing debts through an agency and the agency is actually the debtor,
mm-hmm.
and so the market looks to that government agency as the ultimate security, then we're talking about a very different financing arrangement. That's a standard municipal bond issuance or, you know, public finance problem.
Right. I think I was speaking just a little bit more to the processes through which the nonprofit would have to go through in issuing it. I mean, just looking at through the government conduit and not having the government actually be responsible for it.
Right. Yes, you could do that. Yes. Yep. The state law might just have a few provisions which describe good good school readiness capital partnerships, or the
right.
state may say, actually, we're going to set up a little agency, and everybody's bonds have to go through this agency, get approved, and with the approval, we're just saying that we authorize, and these are operations with which the school districts can actually do business. The ultimate repayment is the responsibility of the capital partnership, not of the government. Yep, that makes sense. That's a social impact bond framework. Let's see if there's any other questions. Well, we have been going for about an hour and a half. And I want to thank all of you for participating. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to contact me or Bob Lighten or anyone else who's involved in this project, either through the Human Capital and Economic Opportunity Working Group or through Ready Nation. So to all of you, thank you.
Rob, let me take the liberty of speaking for everybody else. So thank you for an incredibly informative webinar.
Oh, absolutely.
My first time. Thank you.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
Look forward to doing more of them.
Great day.
Yeah, thanks,
thank
Rob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Hello?
Bye.